Hi folks, Barry here. Just before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with our guest Alan Flanagan, all about the world's worst misunderstanding. Thank you to Patreon donor Jenny D'Souza for suggesting that topic. And this is the last episode of 2021 that's going out. That won't be our best of episode. That'll be coming out just after Christmas. So we appreciate and are grateful to each and every one of our Patreon donors who have helped support us through what's been a weird old 12 months. Started with me recovering from my lung operation. Ben had an abscess, in and out of lockdowns and COVID continuations and bits and pieces of work for us and a live show and all sorts of stuff. So we are grateful to every person who supports the podcast, be it by listening or by shouting about us online or by chucking us a few quid on patreon.com/worstfootforward. As I said, next week's episode is our best of 2021 episode, where we'll have clips from the past 12 months worth of recordings. And then the wheel turns round again, and we've already got two episodes recorded for the start of 2022. Oh God. And COVID permitting. I think that's the sound that's just circulating all of our brains at the moment. But COVID permitting, we will have a live recording on the 20th of February, 2:30 p.m. at Vault Festival in London's Waterloo. We've already got YouTuber Johnny Chiodini and scummy mummy Ellie Gibson booked as guests for that World's Worst Games Night. That's what the show will be. And we're still working on getting a third guest lined up for that as well. So hopefully, I know a couple of you already bought your tickets already, which is very, very exciting. And God, I hope that you're right. And the big corona monster disappears into the ether somehow in the next few weeks. And we'll get to see a lot of you there. Real talk, guys. We know it's been a... there's no way of not underselling what I am about to describe as a difficult year. COVID continues to baffle and batter us. And we realise we are in a privileged position where each and every week we get to speak to thousands of you, literally thousands of people, and be silly in your ears. And we hope that for you it is a joyful thing. It's a joyful thing for us to continue making this show. And we hope we get to keep doing it for a long, long time yet to come. So however you're dealing with Omicron and all of its attendant uncertainties, we hope that the hour or so of silliness that we provide is small comfort, but comfort nonetheless. And knowing that you're listening to us is comfort indeed as well. And hopefully, God, I'd love to be able to hug a load of you and lick your faces in February. Not sure that'll happen, but thank you for keeping on listening. And for keeping us working and for sending us stupid things on Twitter and on Discord. We have a Twitter, @worstfoot. We have a Discord. The link is in the description of this episode. Follow us on those if you want to keep in touch. Or send us an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com and just let us know how you're doing. If you're on your own at Christmas, or you're locked away, or are isolating, we hope this episode will give you a chuckle on Christmas Day. And just a couple of days later, we'll have our best of the past year episode as well. So hang on in there. You're all doing great. And if you're one of those people who likes to get in touch with us every year to send a selfie of yourself listening to the podcast on Christmas Day. God, we do love you for that. Please do send them to us again on Twitter or via email, and we will, with your permission, post them. And it's quite nice putting faces to the avatars and to the social media handles and stuff. And Ben and I will admit it is very cool to think that people take time out of their holiday celebrations to think of us. And we're thinking of you. We hope that 2022 will be better than the last year. If it isn't, though, at least it's still providing more material for the podcast, eh? Silver linings and all of that. Stay well, stay safe, get your vaccinations. We love you lots. Enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to Worst Foot Forward, friends, the podcast that each week uncovers the best of the worst. I'm Ben van der Velde, and this week you find me going toe-to-toe with a Duolingo owl as I try to convince it that Geordie is a legitimate language, magpies are a noble bird, and referring to someone as a canny bugger is a form of endearment rather than a hate crime. Truth be told, I'm not sure how well it's going, and I may well have started a diplomatic incident in the 100-acre wood. Luckily, I'm joined by one of the most level-headed, fair-minded people I know, who is happy to overlook any mouth-footed mistakes. So please welcome Belfast's finest Presbyterian heterosexual bodybuilder, Barry McStay.
I take issue with so much of that, apart from the bodybuilder bit.
Yeah.
I'll take that one. I'll take that one. You've just reminded me, because we were chatting beforehand about the types of misunderstanding that might come up, and our guest mentioned mistranslations, and reminded me, I worked in Australia for a year in 2004-2005 in a school as a teaching assistant, and so I'd often be, you know, supervising study periods and things like that, and I had one kid ask me what time it was, and I said 6:30. And it blew his mind. And he was like, do you mean 3:00? Because he thought about 6:30, obviously.
There's a wonderful Australian comedian called Damo Clark, who lives in Ireland, actually, who has that as a joke. He couldn't understand it. Like, my mates told me they'd meet somewhere at 8:30, turned up at 4:00, had a boring 4 hours waiting for them.
Yeah, but another child in that same study period, I shit you not, asked me to spell something which had the letter R in it. And our guest, who is also Irish, is nodding, because in Ireland, I would spell my name B-A-R-R-Y. Mm-hmm. But over here, and indeed in Australia, when I if he was asking how to spell my name and I said B-A-R-R-Y, he thought I meant B-A-O-R-O-R-Y.
So that would be Bowery.
Yes.
I've had the tight misunderstanding with my son. I just got him a little sort of calendar with a clock in it so he can learn to tell the time. And he put one hand to 7, one hand to the number 5, and went, Daddy, it's 5 to 7. I'm like, that's real solid logic, little man.
Good,
real
good
solid
effort,
logic.
Though. My nephew, my husband's sister's son, one Christmas, when he was quite young, I think he was still about 2, we were all having a big family get together, and I was doing that thing you do with children where you sort of pretend to be doing something very silly and you tend to misunderstand something, and they're like, no. And eventually I sort of caved and said, and his name's Yowen. I said, oh, I'm sorry, my mistake, Yowen. And he said, my no mistake, my Yowen.
Oh, that's a hell of a way to break it to him.
Yes.
Yes. I'm afraid your full name is Our Mistake, Yowen.
Let me introduce our guest today. Our guest today is a writer of theatre, radio, television and film from the town of Lanesborough in County Longford, Ireland. If you've not heard of Longford, it's famous for being the home of our guest. If you've not heard of our guest, he's famous for being from Longford, and so on. He's been in London for 10 years and has been writing for the Channel 4 soap opera Hollyoaks for the past 3, and he also works as a co-producer for horror audio drama Dark Shadows for Big Finish. FYI, all shadows are dark. He also has a Doctor Who connection like myself, having written an audio adventure for the 7th Doctor, Sylvester McCoy. His theatre work runs the gamut from sexual health to rural horror, sounds like my early fumblings, with his upcoming show about parallel universes, The Silver Bell, premiering at Vault Festival this January, a festival at which we also have a live show. And if you only make it to one of those shows, well, I think we all know which one you should see.
But if you don't make it to ours in this universe, you can make it to ours in a different universe.
Exactly. He's also our 3rd guest to have appeared on the brilliant quiz show Only Connect. And I now leave it to the fans of that show to try guess who the 4th guest in that sequence will one day be. His love of board games and Dungeons & Dragons has only been intensified by 2 years spent socialising on Zoom, so we best get a move on and roll for initiative with our inspired hero, Alan Flanagan.
How are ye? Thank you for having me. This is lovely. This is something to do. Isn't it great to have something to do?
It's great to have something to do. It's great to be doing something on Zoom that isn't mollifying family members or playing board games in an unnatural way.
Yeah, I'm playing board games during Zoom meetings, which has been something that I've definitely fallen prey to, and then been asked a question and not been able to answer, because it's in my head because you mentioned spelling your name. But I it was extremely triggering for me, the idea of spelling something as an Irish person, because I used to live in Canada, and the North American accent is you know, it's fairly different. But obviously, if you start a job anywhere, the first department that you go to is human resources. And the amount of Irish people trying to ask where HR was, and people just looking at you as if you're saying, hey, chore, as in you're like waving at a task or something like that.
I realize that I now, when I'm spelling my name, it's actually like an effortful thing for me to say R. I'll still pronounce it rhotically. I won't go so far as saying ah. I am not caving completely to the inabilities of the people in this country I have chosen to live in to understand my language.
I used to teach for years and I just would not give in. I would just, if I was spelling something, I would just stare the student down until they realized what was happening, that I wasn't putting the word or in the middle of a spelling. I won't give in to this. This is kind of south of England nonsense. North of England, yes. If you have a good handle on their ors.
Thank you very much. Well, also, I think that it may be, because generally speaking, around the world, Irish people have a reputation for being...
careful.
No, just that you're considered to be very level-headed and fair-minded, and it's because people think you keep saying the word or every three words. Is it this or this or this? Yes. Like the Irish, they love giving you options.
Choices. It's all about choices.
Always good at seeing both sides of the arguments, the Irish. That's what they all say about us.
Yeah. Yes, level-headed is never a term I've heard.
Yeah, okay, fine. That was a theory that lasted a good 15 seconds before it was dead in the water. But also, that means that actually, let's flip it on its head. The Irish are responsible for both siding of all arguments.
Yeah, that's us.
We are and we aren't, Ben.
Oh no.
I'm harking back to that phrase, well, I am and I amn't, which is just such an Irish way of saying both things and neither at once, and it's your job to understand what I mean.
Yeah, or if someone asks you how you are and you go, Asher, you know yourself, refusing to get off the fence.
We will not be drawn.
Yes. I have no comment to make on how I feel at this time.
I am your one in that last series of Line of Duty, just sitting there, wasting 15 minutes of the audience's time saying no comment.
Yeah. And we've discovered that you are very good at adapting to the rigors of living anywhere around the world. But what are you not so good at?
I was going to say I am a really sore loser, which is not good when I like playing board games and games. And that was what I was going to lead with. And I kind of have built up over time a kind of shell of smile and nod, even though I'm, but then I put it out to my friendship group and one of them immediately came back and said DIY. And he lived with me for several years, so he knows. But yeah, I think DIY is, it's a combination of I can't and I don't want to, which means that most of my life is spent looking at something that is broken and never fixing it. And then maybe 5% of the time is spent trying to fix it and failing miserably. I hung pictures in my room years ago only because we were shooting a film in there. It sounds very OnlyFans, but we were shooting a film and I had to make it look like a room that wasn't lived in by a psychopath. And I hung them on the wall using those like stickery strip things. This is what I call DIY as well, hanging a picture. Yeah. And in the middle of the night, I was struck by a very large picture falling off the wall and the corner of it hitting me in the forehead and then smashing and glass flying everywhere.
Oh no, we're just in the process of making the house that we moved into 16 months ago more of a home, and I've got lots of pictures that I have a relationship of regret with because I barely trust myself to hammer a nail into a wall in the right configuration, and my wife absolutely does not, and so I feel a great deal of empathy with you there, my friend.
But at least you're doing it. I mean,
I'm thinking about doing it.
Okay, good. I realized, because I moved house in July, I realized that there are things that never got unpacked in my house before this. So they've just moved in a box, like framed photos. They've moved in a box from several, I should have just thrown them out or burnt them years ago.
You didn't do the thing what you do, which is you just sort of lay them against the skirting board below the place they will eventually hang and then just leave them there for several months.
I feel like as someone who falls over a lot, that would not end well for me.
No, that just makes the pictures look like, you know, if you go to a really old graveyard and they've had to move some of the headstones and just lean them against the fence to make room for the new bodies. That's what you're...
And now I'm just attracted to the idea of leaning headstones against the wall in my living room and waiting for someone to ask questions.
I'm just a very loose serial killer. Like, I know...
It could be you. Are your cards light? Bringing a date home and just being like, what'd you say your name was again? And getting your chisel out. That with an irony.
Yeah.
Managing to do that thing of combining sexual health and rural horror straight away, Al. You're
absolutely
really on brand.
Love it.
Absolutely. It's who I am. It's how I live. And it's probably why I would go to prison.
For the first first time in a while, this week's topic is a Patreon suggestion. So hello to long-time listener and long-time supporter Jenny D'Souza, who a few months ago got in contact after giving us a £5 a month donation and asked us to do this week's topic, which is the world's worst misunderstanding. And gentlemen, she has laid down a challenge to us. Her all-time favourite misunderstanding, and it's a good one, took place just over a year ago, and it is Donald Trump / Rudy Giuliani's four seasons total gardening fiasco.
The greatest day in human history.
The greatest day in human history. Barry, for those who somehow missed this, would you mind explaining to our listeners what it was?
Oh, they had one of those, one of their, by now, much-loved, long-running, demented press conferences where they complained that democracy had stolen their dictatorship from them. And they had very evidently wanted to book the Four Seasons Hotel and instead rocked up at what turned out to be the Four Seasons landscaping business next door to, I believe, a strip club, and then just brazened it out and pretended they had booked this one deliberately.
It's astonishing. It really is. And this, do you know what? This might just be an episode, I'm going to say it now, where the winner is the listener who suggested the topic.
I also wanted to clarify, I think it was a dildo shop rather than
dildo
a
shop,
club.
Yes. Yeah. No, to be fair, I don't want to denigrate the good people of the campaign.
We're here for facts. Facts only. Yes.
It's so embarrassing when you turn up to a strip club and all you've got instead is a dildo shop.
Yeah. Where do you tuck the dollar bills?
Yeah. Well, you've got to hope one of them is a magnetic dildo and there is a magnetic board somewhere and you can... I mean, now I'm just thinking, you know, stick the dollar bill to the board. And now I'm wondering about what the impact of a magnetic dildo would be.
It can't be a good thing. I'm just imagining scientists trying to run away from it. And, you know, like in the beginning of like a sci-fi film where things are going horribly wrong. There's paper flying everywhere and people being sucked into it.
Yeah. What? I'm just imagining if the polarity of the Earth's poles was reversed and suddenly all these dildos, like you say, are just flying everywhere and chasing scientists everywhere.
The dildos are migratory, you say?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Ask not for who the dildo tolls.
Oh, the beautiful flocks of dildos traveling north for the winter. I can only assume that the owner of the dildo shop saw the bunch of pricks in the Trump campaign and thought, the new stock delivery has arrived.
Hey!
And brought them inside. Anyway, I am starting us off with something from America as well. The US Declaration of Independence, what date was it signed?
1770 something?
1776, yes, on the which date?
Oh, 4th of July, right?
No. It's one of those history facts that isn't really necessarily fully a history fact. On the 2nd of July, the Second Continental Congress voted to declare independence. The final language of the Declaration of Independence was approved on July the 4th, printed and distributed on July the 4th to 5th. Most delegates signed it, but not all delegates were present. Turns out, liberal lefty New York... It took a bit of time to confirm that they were actually going to be one of the original 13 colonies. And so it was only on the 15th of July that New York's delegates got permission to agree to the declaration.
Of course, the New York delegates decided to sign it on Jewish time. They're like, we need the lawyers to look after it and check out all the wording.
And there's a legal historian called Wilfred Ritz who concluded in the 80s that about 34 of the signatories signed it on July the 4th. And the rest of it signed it probably on August the 2nd. Jefferson, Adams, Benjamin Franklin, they all said it had been signed on July the 4th. Majority of people had done then, but there were a few latecomers to it. I really like the story of Peter Sellers working on Casino Royale. Peter Sellers had a reputation, obviously, for being a bit of a difficult person to work with. And when Leo Jaffe, who was the chair of Columbia Pictures, sort of wandering around the set of Casino Royale, he greeted Peter Sellers thinking he was Woody Allen. 60s Sellers and Woody Allen look fairly similar to each other. Big glasses, similar sort of facial shape, similar hair, the whole lot. And so Sellers, being a bit of a good mimic, decided to roll with it. He thought, you know, I'll just pretend I'm Woody Allen. And Leo Jaffe had come to Woody Allen to complain about Peter Sellers, saying they wished he'd never signed him up to appear in the movie. So Peter Sellers stormed off set and stormed out of the country. It wasn't even the first time it had occurred. that had also happened on the set of What's New Pussycat.
Incredible. So can I just ask, you said he stormed out of the country. Like, it's easy to storm out of a room, which is like, good day, sir, into a taxi, yeah, all the way to the airport, through passport control, up the stairs, into the plane. Did you slam the plane door as well?
Yeah, hopefully, yes. and then said, and I'm staying out, as the plane took off. I think they had to finish the film with bits of sort of, you know, they had to do some clever editing and stuff to finish the film off. That's a case of mistaken identity that has a fairly minor effect in his life. Let me tell you about the man who travelled under the names John Smith and Lord Wilton de Willoughby in 1877 and 1896. This was an individual who basically conned women out of their jewellery, gave them rubber checks and things like that. Unfortunately, this chap, this con man, looked a lot like another fella called Adolf Beck. This is a very famous case in British legal history, it turns out. Late 1800s police work wasn't the strongest. And they might have considered certain evidence, such as the fact that Beck was in Peru during the initial crime spree, as a mitigating factor. Or perhaps that the actual criminal, the guy who was pretending to be John Smith or Lord Wilton Willoughby, real name Frederick Mayer probably, was circumcised, according to the women he conned, whereas this chap Beck was not.
I love that lineup idea, though.
Yes.
please identify the man.
Yeah.
a naked attraction style lineup where they're slowly revealed from the bottom up.
Well, the thing is, they did, I don't know how much of a lineup they did, but they did do eyewitness identification during this case, and 16 people positively identified this man, Beck, as being the actual criminal, with them not looking at all the evidence and this mistaken, the fact that he looked quite like the criminal in question. And there were lots of legal miscarriages as well. It multiplied into 15 convictions, 7 years of penal servitude. 3 years after his release, he was 60 years old at that point and was then convicted of more Lord Willoughby crimes. Locked up again for another 4 to 5 years. This time when he was locked up for the second time, the original crook was caught in the act. And Beck was released, and there was a whole public hoo-ha, and he was awarded £5,000 in compensation in his 60s, at which point I'm sure the medicine of the Victorian age will have done for him. But yeah, it's become a bit of it's one of those cases in British legal history which demonstrates the unreliability of eyewitnesses. It's probably one of the things that wouldn't happen these days to an extent. We've got so much CCTV and we're so much more used to maybe, you know, photographs and
dick pics would be
dick pics, yes,
huge, yeah, amount of evidence. Yeah,
also entirely true.
Please introduce for the record the dick pics.
Yes. Exhibit A. I'm gonna give you another American one, which I'm sure both of you will have read in your travels. Jimmy Carter. It's a popular one when you Google famous misunderstandings from history. Jimmy Carter's visit to Poland in 1977 with his translator Stephen Seymour, who was a New Yorker, who had done pretty well on the qualifying exams for both Polish and Russian when he was applying to work in the State Department. And he was judged excellent at both languages, and he was deemed capable of handling the most difficult assignment in State Department work, which is interpreting for the President of the USA. However, Polish journalists who attended Jimmy Carter's visit in 1977, as I said, noted that they thought Stephen Seymour spoke very rusty Polish, which led to translations such as Jimmy Carter saying he wanted to learn about the Polish people's desires for the future, and Seymour translating that as their lusts for the future. Carter said he was happy to be in Poland. Seymour said he was happy to have grabbed Poland's privates.
Oh, wow. I thought that was going to be, I'm happy to be in Poland. Like,
I think it was essentially that, yes.
Yeah, I'm in all of you, Poland.
And Carter also talked about going to the US on a trip. Seymour said that he had left America permanently. Abandoning it.
It's very kind of like stag do mentality to a lot of this translation.
Yes. It's very raunchy. Who knew Polish could be so, Polish words were so, you know, X-rated. It drew apparently giggles from the Polish crowd welcoming Carter at the airport, although the Polish communist leader Edward Gierek and their officials managed to keep a straight face.
I don't want to besmirch the national character of the fine Polish people, but I don't associate giggling with Polish people.
Yeah. Maybe snickering would be more.
I mean, I associate snickering with Scooby-Doo, who, again, yeah. I don't really think of as being from Gdansk.
I mean, you don't have all the information. He could be.
He's definitely
a Dane.
Oh, my God.
You were knocking them out of the park today.
It walked into that. And one Polish journalist said, it looks as if Seymour learned his Polish from a grandfather or somebody who must have emigrated from some backwoods of Eastern Poland decades ago. He used antiquated words and strange grammars just like uneducated Polish peasants still do.
What an unnecessary dig when you're just talking about what happened.
Yeah, people from your own... He's managing to dig people in his own country as well.
So, yeah.
apparently, President Carter had replaced Seymour by the time of the state banquet later in the trip. And I've got one more from the Cold War. 1956, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev very famously reported, again, at the Polish embassy in Moscow this time, he said to Western ambassadors, "We will bury you." And magazines and newspapers across the West reported these comments, helping to, you know, add whatever the opposite of fuel is to whatever the opposite of a fire is. And however, what Khrushchev really probably meant is that whatever you think, communism is here, is going to outlast you all. You'll be dead and buried and communism will still be here. History's on our side and so on. And he was saying that capitalism would destroy itself from within rather than saying communism was necessarily going to destroy it. Khrushchev had to later clarify that statement as well. He once said in 1963 in Yugoslavia, "I once said we will bury you and I got into trouble with it." I don't think he made it better by the following bit. "Of course we will not bury you with a shovel. Your own working class will bury you."
Incredible. And actually, to be fair to Khrushchev, it wasn't him that said it. It was a mistranslation from his translator, Viktor Sukhodrev, who I read a little bit about, who this was one of his first jobs. And he went on, he didn't end up on a gulag or just on the unemployment queue. He had a 30-year career in the diplomatic service. Richard Nixon referred to him as a superb linguist who spoke English as well as Russian. Henry Kissinger said he was unflappable and a splendid interpreter. Now listen, they're not the greatest references that you ever want to end up on your CV, but my favourite one is, according to the International Herald Tribune, he was present but not present, emptying himself of ego, slipping into the skin of the man who was speaking, feeling his feelings, saying his words. So maybe he was like, well, that's not quite what the words that Khrushchev is saying, but I know what he means.
Yes, putting a bit of flavour.
But my favourite thing about him is he penned his memoir in 1999, which in Russian is Yazyk Moy, Drug Moy, which translates as "My tongue is my friend."
I enjoyed the phrase, "I'm slipping into the skin of the man who was speaking," which feels very, very, very erotic mistranslation.
Yeah.
Maybe he was saying it in Polish. We've learned that Polish is a very sexy language. So.
It is, yeah.
But my world's worst misunderstanding, I'm going to quite a famous one in Britain, and I'm going to Christmas 1170 and King Henry II and his outburst at his castle in Burez in Normandy. And he'd just been informed that Archbishop Thomas of Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury, had excommunicated a number of bishops that supported the king. Quite famously, he's reported as having said something along the lines of, "Who shall rid me of this turbulent priest?" Edward Grimm, who was present at Thomas Becket's murder, later wrote The Life of St. Thomas, quotes him as actually saying, "What miserable drones and traitors have I nurtured and promoted in my household, who let their lord be treated with such shameful contempt by a low-born cleric." Later, it's a much later version where we get the sort of the more famous quote. 1740, the bookseller Robert Dodsley writes a chronicle of the kings of England, and he says the words are, "O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this turbulent priest?" Mimicking a quote from the Bible, Romans 7:24, "O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of this death?" Whoever you take it from, and by the way, it doesn't appear in T.S. Eliot's The Murder of the Murder in the Cathedral, which is the play about Becket's murder.
To be fair, T.S. Eliot wasn't performing verbatim theatre.
Much shame to T.S. Eliot, I say. he should have done the research.
Yeah. It does feel like, that, you know, the original line of "Who will rid me of these troublesome priests?" It's a bit melodramatic, isn't it?
Yeah. In the 1964 film Becket, King Henry, who is played by Peter O'Toole, says, "Will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest?" They decided turbulent wasn't the right word, it turns out. Anyway, whatever that the king said, The point is that four knights, Reginald Fitzurse, Hugh de Morville, William de Tracy, and Richard Le Breton, travelled all the way from Normandy to Canterbury with the intention of forcing Becket to overturn his excommunications or drag him back to Normandy to face the king.
It's got a real lads on tour vibe, doesn't it?
It really did. And they confronted him at Canterbury Cathedral, and when he resisted arrest, they slashed him with their sword. The Wikipedia article says, slashed at him with their swords, killing him. We only intended to slash him. We didn't know that would happen. Nobody, even at that time apparently, believes that Henry directly ordered Becket to be killed. It seems like even the sort of contemporaries were like, this wasn't a direct order. I mean, it wasn't, but it probably had quite a lot of heavy subtext. That subject, and the subtext, it sort of comes from not saying, if only somebody would kill Thomas of Becket for me, but actually it's the bit before that where he says, what miserable drones and traitors have I nurtured and promoted in my household who let their lord be treated with such contempt? They're sort of reacting to the fact that he's complaining about the court and those around him bringing shame on the king by letting the king be shamed by others. So they probably thought that failure was actually some sort of treachery, that they could be punished by death if they didn't do something about it.
I don't know if this is helpful, but all the while you've been talking about this kind of meeting, I've just been picturing it as a Real Housewives kind of dinner, because it's the only way I can really picture anything, you know.
Tearing each other's weaves off the whole
absolutely life. Absolutely, yeah.
Following his murder, Becket was venerated. Henry had a lot of questions in the press to answer. Pope Alexander forbade him to hear mass until he'd done penance, which he did in 1172. And the knights were advised to flee by Henry, and they took refuge in de Morville's castle at Knaresborough. And de Morville and two of the knights then funded a church to be built at Ackborough near Scunthorpe. However, the fact that they built an entire church didn't impress Pope Alexander, who still excommunicated all of them in 1171. Then Henry II's expedition to Ireland took place, which Alan and I will know all about.
Great times for everyone involved.
Great times for all involved, set off a chain reaction that none of us are still paying for these days. So there was a little bit of a delay while a couple of the knights took part in that rebellion. And then the Archbishop's murderers finally gained an audience with the Pope, and they did penance to him. And then the Pope had... that apology is all well and good, but now you've got to go off and do the Crusades for the next 14 years.
Oh, that's some pretty hefty detention the Pope set for them.
The Pope liked Thomas of Becket a lot, it turns out. But all of that set in motion by the King's slightly passag comments over dinner.
I choose to believe that it was kind of a sideways order of murder. I mean, you don't like... When you've got people who are like mad about murder sitting around you, you don't make... vague statements. Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if Thomas of Becket died. I enjoyed like looking at a lot of different things, but I feel like the one thing that was hard to avoid was the prevalence of the word nuclear bomb when looking up misunderstandings. Like you talk about the Cold War there, but I think it's really hilarious and horrifying that we just live in this on this big planet with all these nuclear weapons, and I feel like the world is like a Texas Republican's house full of guns, and we just live there. And whoops, one might go off every once in a while because I thought it was an intruder. But there's kind of like lots and lots and far, far, far too many examples of almost going to nuclear war by accident. So in 1979, I think it was at Peterson Air Force Base, basically everything went to hell. So there was a notification that there were 250 ballistic missiles coming from the Soviet Union for the United States. And at that point, a decision needs to be made by the president within like 3 to 7 minutes. Then it was upgraded to 2,200 missiles, which feels like... it feels like A, someone's making a mistake anyway, but we're going in the wrong direction here. So everyone gets told this is happening. And obviously the president is going, we should probably fire back. Also, the kind of firing back thing I find, I can understand in one way, but you're like, what is this going to achieve if you get nuked and you be like, well, at least we also killed a bunch of people. But anyway, that's nuclear policy for another time.
No, that's right. In the words of the great Tom Lehrer, we will all go together when we go. All suffused with an incandescent glow.
Yeah, if I can't have you, then nobody can. kind of attitude to global
politics. I love that your summation of nuclear policy is the jilted lover clause.
Yes, like standing there on like in the aisle of the church with a gun, kind of vibe.
It's the whip of the Balrog slashing up to grab Gandalf.
excellent reference. What had actually happened was, and this is like, this kind of stuff makes you really afraid. Someone had loaded in a training, I don't know what you call it, training program into an active
training
program.
Exercise.
Thing, training exercise into an active program. I just have this image of someone there with like a flop. I presume a floppy disk, or I don't know. I'm now imagining like a record.
feeding in tape with loads of holes punched in it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Charles Babbage is there.
And, yeah.
So essentially, someone had fed a training exercise in it. It read as a real exercise, and that kind of. Yeah, that's terrifying enough.
The thing I love about the NORAD false alarm, which this one is, Congress learned quickly about this incident because a senator, Charles H. Percy, happened to be present at the NORAD HQ during the panic. It's like the school goes on fire during an Ofsted inspection. But not only that, a US State Department advisor, Marshall Shulman, commented, "False alerts of this kind are not a rare occurrence. There is a complacency about handling them that disturbs me."
Yeah,
which kind of feeds in nicely to the fact you're about to give another example of it.
They're so common. There's like a timeline of them that you can look up, which is terrifying. Of like, oh, whoopsie, and also these are ones that are made public, which makes you kind of go, what are the more minor ones that didn't make it to the public kind of notice?
I think I've spoken about it before about bottleneck theory as to why we haven't encountered any alien civilization, and it's because. As civilization advances, there is something that gets in the way that means they will inevitably fail, be it global warming or nuclear war or something like that. And I like to think that there are just loads of alien civilizations out there that have died of nuclear devastation just because some idiot pressed the button when he wasn't meant to. And it also feels appropriate for humans that if we do end up in a nuclear holocaust, it's not because they've been fired in anger, just that they've been fired by mistake. It just feels very narratively satisfying.
Yeah. My only hope is that because we keep accidentally almost doing it, is that when push comes to shove, the individuals involved are really hesitant to actually do it, which I think is hopefully why these things aren't going ahead. I think like in all these situations, someone's gone, let's just check this again.
That's very true. But of all the phrases to use, when push comes to shove is not something you should be using when the nuclear button is in discussion.
Yes, do not let the sugar babes loose in that room, because they will push the button. Which I believe was written about the Cold War.
I think it was their famous Cold War anthem. The sugar.
Yeah, they're pro-nuclear arms war.
Yeah. They said to Naina, we see your 99 red balloons and we give you one red button to push.
They had been waiting patiently, to be fair. Yeah. There's an endless list of these almost rants, but my favorite one, because of the lunacy of kind of how it started, was this is in 1962 at Duluth Sector Direction Center. A guard there basically sees a figure climbing the security fence, okay, and like starts shooting at the figure, going, oh no, someone's trying to break into here. It's clearly our enemies. It's all Cold War, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So activates the sabotage alarm, which sets off alarms at all the bases in the area.
And the Beastie Boys.
And the Beastie Boys. And the Beastie Boys.
Deploy the Beastie Boys.
It's Beastie Boys versus Sugar Babes. It's definitely a comic relief kind of vibe.
Yes.
There's a base in Wisconsin, which instead of setting off the sabotage alarm, sets off the nuclear alarm. Then the nuclear-armed F-1068 interceptor planes take off. Something I've read several times is that there's no kind of, they don't do like training or false alarm exercises. When they hear the alarm, they take it as read that this is what's happening. They were only stopped as they were going down the runway. And what I really like about this is that it took to the point of dropping nuclear bombs. But what had actually happened was that the figure climbing the security fence, they believe was a brown bear. That had wandered over to the place. So basically, a bear climbing a fence almost led to World War III.
Ah, but are we sure it wasn't a Russian bear?
Yeah,
it was deployed. But I just find there are so few steps. That's the issue. There are so few steps between bear and nuclear war. I think there's two in that case. I feel like there should be more. It feels like there should be more. It should be harder to start nuclear war than it is to like make chicken curry.
You are right. Like the flow chart is alarmingly short.
Yeah. it's one of those cosmopolitan quizzes where you always have to tickle his perineum, no matter what route you go.
I mean, what? That escalated.
Don't question it, Ben. Don't question it. Just go.
Don't question it. Yeah.
Okay.
Don't fight it.
I mean, I've not tickled many perineums in my time, but if that's how we accidentally end up in nuclear war, I'm going to maintain my 100% record.
When they say push the button.
Yeah, that's what they were talking about. To be fair, if the president had to tickle a perineum in order to start a nuclear war, I feel like no nuclear war would ever start.
Yeah, calling it a nuclear football, that thing they carry around with them, is very macho. If they called it a let's call it a nuclear dildo and see how keen they are to get their hands on it.
We've got magnetic dildos, nuclear dildos.
Yeah.
Yeah. World War III will be fought with nuclear weapons, but World War IV will be fought with magnetic dildos.
Oh, Einstein, you wag.
You don't want to use one of those if you had a metal hip replacement. Just try burrow.
Gonna get you.
And this is why we don't get taken seriously as a history podcast. For my suggestion, there was a lot of mistranslations as well that I looked up. But first, we are going to wander into the murky waters of what constitutes Britain, what constitutes Great Britain, what constitutes the United Kingdom, and what constitutes the British Isles. This is difficult for British and Irish people to think of, I imagine, although I guess I'm speaking to a pair of Irishmen and you might go, we know bloody well what's ours and what's yours.
We've labelled our stuff. Yeah.
those are my eggs.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, you may have labelled your stuff, but it very much part of British history is going around going, I'm going to take this label off and replace it with a small Union Jack. This was particularly difficult in the circumstances at 2012 of a Welsh scientist called Michael Crowley Milling. Now, he is a big name in the world of 21st century technology. Amongst his many skills, he was one of the inventors of the touchscreen. However, he made a mistake in his will. He left millions. Specifically, he said that all his wealth within the United Kingdom would be left to the Royal Society. However, all his wealth resided in the British Isles, specifically within Jersey and the Isle of Man. Now, despite his best intentions, as you know and I know, and oh boy, does my tax lawyer wife know, neither of those islands is part of the United Kingdom because they are crown dependencies. And that is why, of course, so much tax-efficient cash flow is put through those two dependencies.
I believe the term is fiduciary shenanigans.
I thought he was a Turkish football manager, but sure. I am just every time I pass our office and hear my wife going, Luxembourg, Cayman Islands, Andorra, Liechtenstein, I have to go, my wife is a good person, my wife is a good person, my wife is a good person. But although these two places are protected by the UK, Jersey and the Isle of Man are not part of our financial system. So the fallout of this is that it led to a legal battle between the professor's family, who went, but we would like the money, and the Royal Society, who went, yeah, come on, let's not get hung up on stuff. We know what he meant. We want the money. And the lawsuit ended up costing £2 million. It went on for months and months and months and months, and thankfully for justice but not his family, the money found its way to the Royal Society.
Was the amount of money £1.9 million?
I don't know, but for a pleasing narrative I'm going to say yes.
Yeah.
I don't know the ins and outs, and I'm sorry if I'm offending anyone listening to the podcast, but I'm not a fan of that family who are like, we must go back on his word in order to get this money.
I'm going to say that settling wills does not bring out the best in people.
No. I think that's a good reason to always give it away, is because it'll ruin your family.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if you want proof of that, if we get 1 million Patreon donors, then we will broadcast the reading of mine and Barry's wills live on Twitch.
conflicting and interlocking wills.
Yes.
Joke's on you. I don't have one. Ben's married to a lawyer. I'm pretty sure she'll have made him make one.
Yeah, not yet. Also, conflicting and interlocking wills is a horrifying gay porn search.
Ooh.
Next, I'm going to tell you a story. This is not true, but I just want it to be true. I think we've talked about similar things before. So there is an apocryphal story that General Motors made a brand of Chevrolet called the Chevrolet Nova. And they absolutely could not sell it for love nor money in Latin America. The reason being that the Spanish translation of Nova is no go. So unsurprisingly, people did not want to buy the Chevrolet no go.
Maybe they just didn't want to buy it because it was a crappy car.
Well, there we go. And maybe it's just the fact that GM Ford cars weren't particularly popular at the time.
Very possibly. Next, we're going to go back to language. We've already spoken about Khrushchev and Jimmy Carter's translators getting it wrong. But now we get to not spoken word, but written word. We go to 1889 and a treaty signed between Italy and Ethiopia. And this is the Treaty of Wuchale. Now listen, this is at the height of colonialism when Europeans were slicing and dicing Africa for well over 50 years. And the Ethiopian version of the treaty, which was dictated in Amharic, which is the Ethiopian language, included a clause agreeing that the Ethiopian emperor could use the Italian embassy to conduct his foreign affairs. However, in the Italian version of the document, it translated the clause rather from the permissive use of the word to the mandatory one, essentially saying that the emperor had agreed that he must use the Italian embassy to do this. And the Italians were delighted with this, since they'd, in their point of view, the Ethiopians had gladly given up their status as a sovereign country to become a colony. The Ethiopians quite reasonably went, we absolutely are not being a colony. We are still very much independent. The resulting mix-up, when it became clear, led to a war. And this is one of my favourite colonial wars because the Europeans lost. And Ethiopia is very proud that they are one of the few African countries to ever defeat a European colonial power. I mean, obviously, sadly, down the line, they lose to Mussolini, which, listen, if you're going to lose a war to a fascist, Mussolini is the embarrassing one to lose to. But I'm not going to judge you, Ethiopia. I think this was a case of the Italians at the time, who, to be fair to Italy, they're a brand new country. They're scrabbling around for any colonial holdings they can get. But they underestimated Ethiopia, who was a very sophisticated country at this time. They had an army of 120,000 men. Half of them had modern rifles. They'd already purchased 50 modern Russian mountain guns, and they completely outfoxed the Italian military, which is something that I never tire of reminding my Italian father-in-law of at Christmas. Yeah.
Which is a real catch-22 for him, because if he gets arsy about it, then he's supporting fascism, so...
Yeah. You don't fully understand my father-in-law's character. He is a lovely, kind, warm man who doesn't stray far from the warm embrace of fascism if it suits his needs.
And that is going into the podcast?
Peter is never listening to the podcast. And also, Barry knows, having played board games with his daughter, her preferred form of government is benevolent dictatorship.
Yeah.
But which, to be fair, is different from fascism.
Oh, you're very right. I've only just now realised that she does call you living room Lebensraum. Yeah.
Hey, she studied German at university. It's a difficult habit to get out of. Admittedly, our living room is located in our neighbour's house, but nevertheless.
So... She always gets jealous when she walks through Soho past Poland Street. I'm so glad your wife isn't on social media so the listeners can't go center the clip from this episode.
Me too. Yeah, that's probably staying in. Right. One last one before my choice. Sometimes people speaking the same language can misunderstand each other, and the most difficult thing, and I think this is genuinely true for people learning British English, is our habit of understatement. Sometimes our cousins across the waters can misunderstand this. Apparently, during the Korean War, a British Army unit was tasked with maintaining control of a hill that overlooked a strategically important river, which was being attacked by Chinese forces. And the situation was desperate because the British unit was outnumbered by 8-1 and surrounded on all sides. the commander of the British unit reported this to his American superior, using the phrase, "Things are a bit sticky, sir," which literally means, "Things are desperate, please help us." However, the American superior, clearly knowledgeable of the British habit for understatement, believed that "things are a bit sticky" meant, "Don't worry, things are difficult but manageable," rather than "we're in a lot of trouble, please send help." And after 4 days, the British position was overrun and 500 out of 600 soldiers were taken prisoner, the rest of whom were either dead or managed to escape.
At which point they sent another message saying, "Things are a bit prisony."
Yeah. Yes, sir.
It's very no worries if not.
Yeah.
Being held prisoner, no worries if not.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It's the absolute version of that. But my favourite one of these, and I'm finding this hard to beat, comes from America in February 1912, when a Mrs. Joseph C. Yeager got a telegraph message from her husband and took drastic and, as it turns out, completely unnecessary measures. The Indianapolis News in Indiana described her husband as a horseman, a gambler, and all-round plunger, a word which I've never heard used in that context before, and I'm enjoying very much. His wife received a hastily scanned telegram, who was at a horse track at the time, and I'm going to read you the punctuation as well, and this is what it said. "Broke, full stop, even lost on Dolly." She panicked, believing that her husband was penniless, and she immediately pawned her $35,000 worth of jewels for $6,000. However, her husband returned home and was furious because what the telegram actually said was, "broke even, full stop, lost on Dolly."
Oh my God.
And unsurprisingly, he found that he had money in his pocket, but his wife had completely sold their very expensive jewels. The couple eventually divorced. Our nominees for the World's Worst Misunderstanding are Barry's nomination of Henry II's passive-aggressive request to have Thomas à Becket murdered, Alan's suggestion of the bear who accidentally almost went nuclear, and my suggestion of the Midwest gambler whose misread telegraph left him out of pocket and out of wife. Very different periods. Very different stakes going on here.
There's a lot of different stakes here.
it's very, there's circles of interpersonal and global.
Yeah.
Yes.
Really is. The story of Thomas à Becket, as I think we've brought it up on the podcast before, and it is historical, it's well known, but it's only just one guy who got killed. And I almost think that that story is a little bit too famous because it's not the
first... Are you trolley problem-ing my suggestion here?
Yes, it's Thomas à Becket versus all of Western civilization.
Let the man talk. I'm going to win this.
I think that Thomas à Becket's story is overplayed because he can't be the first or even the fifth cleric to be killed by a royal with a casual word. So I'm not having him. I'm going to say that mine, Mr. Yeager, is objectively the funniest. It's
the word objectively has never been folded back in on itself so strenuously.
Listen, I will happily use syntactic origami to justify a win on my behalf. But again, the stakes are a $35,000 necklace versus, once again, all of civilization. And it's not the first time that a nearly but not quite nuclear war has won on this podcast, but it is the first time that a member of the animal kingdom other than Homo sapiens has been responsible. And so I am going to choose Alan's suggestion of Yogi the nuclear bear from Duluth.
Yay, I win. I'm the best.
Who nearly made a boo-boo.
Before we go, it's time for the world's best news of the week, which we shall keep going all the way through this Omicron-flavoured winter. And we're going back a couple of months here for an absolutely adorable story of Finley, the adorable golden retriever. Finley is from Canandaigua in New York State. I've definitely mispronounced that. And Finley broke a world record. Gentlemen, What world record do you think he broke?
Goodest boy.
Hard to quantify that, isn't it?
Most nuclear apocalypses almost triggered by an animal.
Blinkers on there, Alan. It's a no and a no. He won the world record. He broke the world record, which had stood for 17 years, of most tennis balls fitted in his mouth at once by a dog.
Goodest boy.
Goodest boy. Would you like to know how many he fitted in? Any guesses?
What did you say? It was a golden retriever?
Yeah.
Like five? How many?
Seven.
Oh, you went either side. Is like Alan, you said the previous record. Barry, you said the currently unattainable record. He fit six tennis balls in his mouth and he looks utterly ridiculous and completely adorable.
That feels dangerous but adorable.
Dangerous but adorable is absolutely my wheelhouse. Get on your Google search engine. Get on your Google search engine. God, I sound 300 years old.
boot up that ass Jeeves, guys. Yeah. Yeah.
Put Finley, the tennis ball mouth world record breaking dog in. Look at the photos and have a lovely 15 seconds of your life. Before we go, Alan, where can our listeners find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
I'm on Twitter at Alan Flanagan, and I have a website, alanflanagan.com, which needs updating. And that's me. And they can also see, like I said, see me at the end of January, from the 26th of January to 6th of February in Vault Festival. I've written a show and I'm in it. So I'm frantically learning lines at the moment. And that, I think, is me.
Marvellous.
Well, your mistake there is writing a show and being in it. I've written a show and I'm not in it. Or, as Ben and I are doing, not having any lines to learn when you're doing live shows.
That's the spirit. We are all off to dress as a pantomime horse and try and breach the security at Her Majesty's nuclear base, Clyde. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.